Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, our resident Vatican watcher, Joan Lewis, takes us on a stroll through the Pope's summer residence at Castel Gandolfo. But first, we introduce Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More to the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The apostles returned to Jesus and reported to him all that they had done and what they had taught. He said to them, "Come by yourselves to an out-of-the-way place and rest a little." People were coming and going in great numbers, making it impossible for them to so much as eat. So Jesus and the apostles went off in the boat by themselves to a deserted place. People saw them leaving, and many got to know about it. People from all the towns hastened on foot to the place, arriving ahead of them. Upon disembarking, Jesus saw a vast crowd. He pitied them, for they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them at great length.
If there's one element that emerges from this gospel, it's surely humanity. The whole passage throbs with life, with people, with movement, with coming and going. First, we have the return of the apostles after their first mission of teaching and healing. And in the way of friends who, when they meet each other after a time spent apart, recount everything that has happened to them in the meantime, the apostles tell Jesus of their doings, where they had succeeded and probably also where they had failed. As in their inability to cast out the unclean spirit from the epileptic boy, and the answer Jesus gave them when they asked him, "Why could we not cast it out?" This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer and fasting. One imagines them all talking at once, telling not only the master, but also each other, for they had gone out in twos and in different directions. Then there would be the inevitable variations in the way each remembered the experience, doubtless in particular between the pairs of brothers, the younger contradicting the elder, and so on. All in all, a general hubbub and confusion, added to which we have the information that there were so many people coming and going that they couldn't even have a meal. It's the second time in Mark's Gospel that we hear of the impossibility for the apostles, and Jesus too, presumably, to do such a normal thing as sit down to eat. The crowds are so great. To us it seems strange that this house of Peter in Capernaum, where presumably all this takes place, should have been open to all and sundry. But even if at first his mother-in-law might have been, to say the least, a bit put out by the constant stream of, we can hardly call them, visitors, she herself had been healed by Jesus and must have been touched by his whole presence. As for the crowds, they would have clamoured at the door if it had been closed. But how often would this have been the case? In a hot country such as Palestine, and a poor man's house such as Peter's, there would have been little reason for keeping the door closed. And then there were the sick, brought by their friends. We read, again in Mark, just after Jesus has cured Peter's mother-in-law.
That evening at sundown they brought to him all who were sick or possessed with demons, and the whole city was gathered together about the door.
And again, a little later.
When he returned to Capernaum after some days, it was reported that he was at home, and many were gathered together, so that there was no longer room for them, not even about the door.
And what did the four men bringing the paralytic do but go up, by the outside stairs, to the roof, and make a hole in it to let his stretcher down? In a manual on daily life in Bible times, we may read,
"The court was at the centre of a Jewish house. Probably this was where Jesus sat when a group of men lowered a paralytic man into the midst to reach him. The court was designed to admit light and air to the rooms around it. Tile or rock paved the floor of the court to shed rain that might come in through the skylight.
And a poem immediately comes to mind on this very theme, or themes. It's Seamus Heaney's The Skylight.
You were the one for skylights. I opposed cutting into the seasoned tongue and groove of pitch pine. I liked it, low and closed, its claustrophobic nest up in the roof effect. I liked the snuff-dry feeling, the perfect trunk-lid fit of the old ceiling. Under there, it was all hutch and hatch. The blue slates kept the heat like midnight thatch. But when the slates came off, extravagant sky entered and held surprise wide open. For days I felt like an inhabitant of that house where the man sick of the palsy was lowered through the roof, had his sins forgiven, was healed, took up his bed, and walked away.
That Jesus was at home when he cured the paralytic doesn't necessarily mean that he was in Peter's house that day. Only the houses of the wealthy possessed a second floor and a roof. It probably means simply that he was in the vicinity of Capernaum, which he had made his base. But what do we know about Peter's house? A pilgrim from Piacenza wrote in 579 of the house of Peter, which is now a basilica. While in 1905, archaeologists unearthed a synagogue in Capernaum, which it's believed was probably built around 300 AD. Today's guidebook tells us more.
Several dwellings dating from the 1st century BC have been excavated around the synagogue. Of special significance is the so-called House of Peter, the architectural history of which can be traced over a period of about 600 years. Between the 1st century BC and the beginning of the 4th century AD, this was a common, poor residence with several rooms grouped around an irregular courtyard. One of the rooms was distinguished by a better floor, or rather a succession of floors of crushed limestone and a painted plaster coating on the walls. In the second stage, in the first half of the 4th century, this room became the centre of a building surrounded by a wall and thus secluded from the town. The room now had a roof supported by an arch. In the middle of the 5th century, this building was levelled and an octagonal church built on the site. Although there's nothing in the early house to identify its owner, its development into a fully recognised church indicates a strong tradition connecting it with Peter and with the activities of Jesus in Capernaum.
And that's as much as we may expect. Tradition, speculation, and a good dose of imagination. In today's gospel, whether they're in the house or outside, the little group of friends are so hemmed in with people they can neither eat nor tell of their experiences without constant interruption and general discomfort. "Let's go somewhere else, somewhere out of the way," says Jesus quietly. "You need to rest a bit." The apostles needed no second telling. To get away, far from the madding crowd, what a familiar feeling. How often do we hear it expressed in our own hectic world? How often have we said it to ourselves? Oh, to get away from it all. For some, as for the poet William Cowper, there's a selfish kind of pleasure in being able to observe the crowd without being part of it.
'Tis pleasant, through the loopholes of retreat, to peep at such a world, to see the stir of the great Babel and not feel the crowd.
For the Elizabethan essayist Francis Bacon, writing on the virtues of friendship,
"A crowd is not company, and faces are but a gallery of pictures, and talk but a tinkling cymbal, where there is no love."
Apologies, of course, to St. Paul. So Jesus and the apostles somehow managed to extricate themselves from the teeming mass and make for the lakeside, where the fishermen's boats are tied up. Peter is there first and has cast off in no time at all, and they're away. What an important part the boat plays in the gospel story. Jesus teaches from Peter's boat. He comes to it walking on the water. He falls asleep in it and is woken by the terrified apostles and stills the storm. Then there are the miraculous draughts of fish. Not all the apostles were fishermen, of course, and one wonders if perhaps some of them, unaccustomed to boats, might not have been just a little uncertain, like those tourists who have bought their tickets for a joyride and are already wishing they had never come.
One by one, we were being handed down into a boat that dipped and shilly-shallied scaresomely every time. We sat tight on short cross-benches in nervous twos and threes, obedient, newly close, nobody speaking except the boatmen, as the gunwales sank and seemed they might ship water any minute.
Peter and John and their brothers were probably much more at home in a boat than in a house, and would have agreed with Arthur Ransom that houses are but badly built boats, definitely inferior things. But the boat was their means of livelihood, not a poetic form of transport, such as Mole experiences in The Wind and the Willows.
"Do you know," said he, as the rat shoved off and took to the sculls, "I've never been in a boat before in all my life."
"What?"
cried the rat, open-mouthed.
"Never been in... You mean you never... Well,
what have you been doing then?" "Is it so nice as all that?" asked the mole shyly, though he was quite prepared to believe it as he leant back in his seat and surveyed the cushions, the oars, the rowlocks and all the fascinating fittings and felt the boat sway lightly under him.
"Nice? It's the only thing,"
said the water rat solemnly as he leant forward for his stroke. "Believe me, my young friend, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, half so much worth doing as simply messing about in boats. In or out of them, it doesn't matter. Nothing seems really to matter. That's the charm of it. Whether you get away or whether you don't, whether you arrive at your destination or whether you reach somewhere else, or whether you never get anywhere at all, you're always busy, and you never do anything in particular. And when you've done it, there's always something else to do."
Well, the life of the Galilean fisherman was far removed from this romantic vision. It was closer to the struggle of The Old Man and the Sea of Hemingway's novel.
The old man fitted the rope lashings of the oars onto the thole pins, and leaning forward against the thrust of the blades in the water, he began to row out of the harbour in the dark. There were other boats from the other beaches going out to sea, and the old man heard the dip and push of their oars, even though he could not see them now, the moon was below the hills. Sometimes someone would speak in a boat, but most of the boats were silent, except for the dip of the oars. They spread apart after they were out of the mouth of the harbour, and each one headed for the part of the ocean where he hoped to find fish.
The Sea of Galilee was not the ocean. The largest freshwater lake in Israel and the country's main water reservoir, it's referred to as a sea like any large expanse of water, more or less enclosed. And as one scholar comments, in Hebrew and Aramaic, there is one word for sea and lake, yam. But one of the peculiarities of the Sea of Galilee has always been its unexpected lakequakes.
Sudden storms swoop swiftly over this low-lying sheet of water, whipping the surface of the lake with fury and covering it with waves that frequently swamp the small rowing boats. The reason is that winds from the west passing over the highlands come swirling down through 100 gorges and narrow valleys into the deep pit in which the lake lies. The water is smooth one moment, and the next it's a raging sea in which men battle for life.
That spring day in the year 29 AD, not long before the Passover, the lake was in an indulgent mood, it seems. But any hopes for Jesus and the apostles of getting away from the madding crowd were soon squashed. For as our gospel tells us, people saw them leaving, and many got to know about it. So, as they were crossing the 6 or 7 miles of water, the crowds, seeing they were only going to the opposite shore, followed on foot. If they lost no time, writes one, by racing round the northern end of the lake and wading over the shallow Jordan, they would reach Bethsaida almost as soon as Jesus. And in fact, as we know, they got there before him.
So as he stepped ashore, he saw a large crowd, and he took pity on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd.
Some 700 years earlier, the prophet Ezekiel had predicted the coming of a good shepherd who would rescue the scattered sheep of Israel. Now he was here.
My flock is straying this way and that. For lack of a shepherd, they have scattered. No one bothers about them and no one looks for them. The Lord Yahweh says this, I am going to look after my flock myself. I shall rescue them from wherever they have been scattered during the mist and darkness. I shall feed them in good pasturage. I myself will pasture my sheep. I myself will show them where to rest. It is the Lord Yahweh who speaks. I shall look for the lost one, bring back the stray, bandage the wounded and make the weak strong. I shall watch over the fat and healthy. I shall be a true shepherd to them. You, my sheep, are the flock I shall pasture.
And he began to teach them many things.
And now, in an exceptional chat with our former colleague, Sister Janet Ferns, Joan Lewis, our resident Vatican expert, takes us on a tour of the papal summer residence of Castel Gandolfo outside Rome. Let's listen.
Pope John Paul II affectionately called this summer residence, and sometimes other parts of the year residence, he called it Vatican II, Vatican Number Two. And Castel Gandolfo is about 25 miles outside of Rome. It is one of what are called the Castelli Romani, or the Roman hill towns, in the Alban Hills south of Rome. Just little teensy, wonderful, picturesque towns that dot these hills and overlook Lake Albano, which is actually a lake on the extinct crater of a volcano. A very beautiful lake, very placid. If you go to Castel Gandolfo and sit in one of the main squares there, just off of the public side of the Papal Palace, there's certain times a year where you can sit there and have a porchetta and a glass of wine. You're just overlooking this gorgeous, wonderful, placid lake. It's very beautiful. And you know, if you really need a change of pace and to just kind of settle back and recharge your batteries, this is the place to do it. And if you ever visited which I have on a number of occasions, the Apostolic Palace there, the Vatican Observatory and the Vatican Gardens, you know why the Pope enjoys it, any Pope enjoys it. And I know the first two times I was there, I thought, why don't they just move the Vatican to Castel Gandolfo? It's so wonderful and peaceful. It couldn't take all of us, and I suppose that would be a good thing. But the name, actually, Castel Gandolfo, comes from the Gandolfi family. They were originally from Genoa. And about 1200 on land that they bought there, they built a small square fortress with crenellated walls. You can see part of this today. And an inner courtyard and towers and adjacent gardens and so forth. They lived there for quite some time, but then in the following century, so 1300s, the Savelli family bought this, and they owned it on and off until 1596, and in that year, they owed Pope Clement VIII a debt which they could not pay, so he got their land. They paid him by giving him this land, and he took the property and in 1604 declared it the patrimony of the Holy See. So over the years, something I won't go into because it would probably be less interesting for our listeners, but over the years, the building was expanded and added to, and chapels and famous names designing facades and rooms within it. And that has just made it the beautiful, lovely home that it is today, very much on a par inside with the Apostolic Palace here in Rome. And perhaps outside, again, because it has this view of Lake Albano, in many, many ways, much more inviting. And I know that there are, for example, apartments very close to the Apostolic Palace in that part of the land that's known as Villa Barberini. There are private apartments, small, for the Cardinal Secretary of State, for the Prefect of the Papal Household, and I know they enjoy it immensely, too. There's this tremendous, wonderful, not just beauty, but intimacy. In any event, at a certain point, the land which comprised the Apostolic Palace and a small percentage of gardens overlooking the lake, there was an acquisition of land under Pius XI. He helped restore some of the buildings that were on this land that had been degraded to a certain degree. And there was also a farm there, which he made, and still is today, a very active, self-supporting farm. They make their own yogurt. When I visited, they gave me samples of everything. They make their own yogurt and their milk and then olive oil, just obviously in certain times of the year. And my understanding is a truck arrives every single morning at 6 o'clock in Rome that has the fresh produce from this farm, and it's brought to the Apostolic Palaces and to certain of the cardinals that have the privilege of getting all these fresh goodies from the farm. So it's a wonderful thing to see. And the farm is part of this new addition of land that came under Pius XI, what was called Villa Barberini. Very often we think of the word villa as referring just to a building. But really a villa is the home and the land around it. So that's what this Villa Barberini was, buildings and land. And the acquisition of this brought the size of Castel Gandolfo up to 55 hectares, so 11 hectares bigger than Vatican City State.
Now, Castel Gandolfo has got some special link, hasn't it, with the Second World War?
This is a wonderful story. It does indeed have a link. When you had, especially in 1944, after the landing at Anzio, you had the citizens of Castel Gandolfo, whose own lives possibly were at risk by staying in their homes in the hill towns. They had been allowed to stay on the grounds of Castel Gandolfo. No one from the other towns, but just the residents of Castel Gandolfo could stay on the grounds of the palace. And Pope Pius XII was a great lover of Castel Gandolfo and, as a matter of fact, spent a lot of time at this residence, except for World War II. But again, the land was given to the citizens so that because it had the status of extraterritoriality, so it was given to protect the citizens of Castel Gandolfo. And to give you some idea of the size and what you can see especially when you're roaming through the gardens. The gardens are some of the most spectacular I have seen in my years on this earth and in my travels. And not that many people see them. Beautifully, beautifully manicured.
Are they open to the public?
No, they're not. They're not open to the public. I mean, I wanted to do a story one day for the Vatican Information Service and went out there and spent the day. And the director of the villas, Saverio Petrillo, allowed me to take pictures to my heart's content. And hours and hours and hours we wandered the premises. And the shrubbery, the flowers, the trees. There are trees. There were cypress trees, which were, this is when you kind of want television so you can see gestures. Cypress trees, which were grown up and then bent over into each other to form an arch. And so what they did in planting all these trees and then bending them over to form an arch, you had a replica, but in trees, of the Roman aqueducts. It's absolutely astonishing.
That's amazing.
It really, really is. The color, the beauty, the fine, it's almost like looking at lace, except that it's flowers and trees and shrubs and beautifully, beautifully taken care of. And
how many people work in Castel Gandolfo?
There's about 60 people for the farm, for the gardens and everything else, and only about 20 live there. So Dr. Petrillo, for example, would be one of those people. And but some of your farmers, other people live in town, come to work. Only a handful, two dozen, actually live on the property. But one of the two of the amazing things about the gardens are, there's 102, but we can't talk about them all. Part of the gardens, a very small part, was designed by Bernini. Believe it or not, we think of him...
Same fellow as the columns in St. Peter's.
Exactly. We think of Bernini and the altar in St. Peter's and many other things, but he did design part of the gardens, and I guess there's kind of a real logic in that. If you can work with stone and marble, couldn't you work with something that is living? But what you do see as you walk throughout the gardens, in addition to what I've, the hedges and the flowers and fountains, there was a beautiful part of the gardens with the statue of Our Lady where John Paul loved to just walk back and forth and say his rosary. And I have a feeling that Benedict's going to enjoy that. But one part of the property is on land, the Emperor Domitian. He was the emperor from 81 to 96. He had built, now you're going to think I've got my figures wrong, he built a 14 square kilometer villa on this site. And Dr. Petrillo showed me, we walked along where some of the walls of this were in the gigantic rooms. Only a few walls are actually available at as you go now to visit it today. But 14 kilometers, square kilometers of rooms and of the gardens and of walking areas.
That's amazing.
The most astonishing thing that I saw, and again, if this was television, we could hold up a picture, so I'll just have to do it with words, the crypto portico. It's in near perfect condition, 2,000 years after it was built, and it's reached by a staircase built into the gardens, and it was constructed to provide the emperor and his guests with a cool place to walk in the summer. Just imagine going into a huge underground tunnel, except that one end of it is solid, is closed. The other end, you exit and enter from the other end. High up on the walls of the tunnel on one side are openings for windows. They were filled with alabaster. And that let the light in, but it kept the heat out. So this crypto portico built below the earth was a very cool place. You and I know how
and
it can be in the summer.
And the light and color from alabaster windows is beautiful.
To go in today is an experience and a half. I had never, ever before or after seen anything like the crypto portico. All of the gardens, all of Castel Gandolfo is very, very special.
And thanks there to Joan Lewis, our resident Vatican expert, and Rome Bureau Chief for EWTN, and of course, to our former colleague, Sister Janet Ferns. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.